From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Parades and fireworks will celebrate the quincentennial of Columbus's discovery of America. But for Native American writer Michael Darras, the anniversary is a chance to imagine the lives of the Indians who welcomed Columbus in 1492. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Darras about his new book, Morning Girl. He's also the author of The Broken Cord, about his adopted son's struggle with fetal alcohol syndrome. Also today, the Arts Censors of the Year. We talk with the director of the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project, Marjorie Hines. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Catholic Girls, a collection of essays by women writers who grew up Catholic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Reports from Angola say that the generals representing the UNITA faction have walked out of a meeting with election officials after threatening a resumption of the civil war. The generals have demanded that the results of last week's elections be canceled. With more than 80% of the vote counted, former Marxist president José Eduardo dos Santos was in the lead with just over 51% of the vote. UNITA's Jonas Savimbi, whose guerrilla war was supported by the United States, was trailing with less than 39%. The election has been supervised by the United Nations, but Savimbi has claimed massive fraud by the ruling party. Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger said earlier today that the United States expects all parties, including Savimbi, to abide by the election results. Polling stations are now closed in Kuwait, where voters are choosing candidates for a new parliament to replace the one dissolved by Kuwait's ruler Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah in 1986. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Kuwait City.
Polling stations were packed here today, with some districts reporting a turnout of better than 90%. 81,000 Kuwaiti men are eligible to vote, those who can trace their ancestry here back to 1920. More than 500,000 other Kuwaiti citizens, including women, are not allowed to vote. Two groups of women held demonstrations today to protest that fact. Kuwait's ruling family agreed to this election under pressure from opposition groups during the Gulf War. Opposition leaders are hoping the ruling family will allow the new parliament to play a substantial role in shaping the country's policy. But Kuwaiti Emir Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah can still suspend the parliament at any time, as he did in 1986 after it criticized royal ministers. I'm Michael Sullivan in Kuwait City.
The Senate voted this evening to override President Bush's veto of a bill to re-regulate cable TV. The bill now moves on to the House, which is expected to follow the Senate's lead. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The bottom line was 74 to 25, with one senator voting present. For the White House, which had been lobbying furiously to sustain the veto, it was a setback. They did not switch one vote, despite twisting arms all weekend and today. Senator Bob Dole, the minority leader, urged his fellow Republicans to disregard policy and vote solely on politics.
This is an effort to embarrass President Bush 30 days before the election, 1 week before the first debate. That's what it's all about. The merits of this legislation have been forgotten. We've got to fight between big money interests on both sides.
But senators could not ignore what had been so successfully portrayed as a pro-consumer bill. It's now up to the House, which approved the legislation by an even larger margin and where Democratic leaders are confident they, too, will override. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones lost 21 points. This is NPR. Emergency workers in Merrim, Indiana, are still searching the rubble of a local power plant for three workers missing after an explosion and fire. Officials say 20 people were injured in the fire at the coal-fired electrical generating plant. 14 were treated at the scene for smoke inhalation, while the others were taken to a nearby hospital. Helicopters were used to rescue as many as a dozen workers who were trapped on the roof of the 200-foot-tall building. There's no word yet on what caused the explosion. A special committee of the Presidential Debate Commission is meeting this evening to decide whether Ross Perot will be invited to join in a series of three debates that begins on Sunday. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Both President Bush and Governor Clinton have said they welcome Mr. Perot to join their debates, but it's not up to them. Both campaigns are waiting for the ruling of the same bipartisan commission that Mr. Bush sought to exclude from earlier negotiations. The commission has a set of criteria Mr. Perot must meet, including objective judgments such as whether he is on enough ballots to win, and more subjective judgments about whether he's a credible candidate. Those include his poll numbers, the state of his organization around the country, and whether he's gotten enough press attention to qualify as a major candidate. Frank Fahrenkopf is co-chair of the debate commission.
If he meets the criteria, he would be included in any debates that the commission produces.
The same goes for Mr. Perot's running mate, James Stockdale. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
The Israeli army said today that it will ban Palestinians from the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip from entering Israel for 48 hours during the Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur. The holiday begins at sunset tomorrow and ends at sunset on Wednesday. Israeli security officials fear that terrorists may try to take advantage of the holiest day in the Jewish year, during which all Israeli businesses are closed, there are no radio or television broadcasts, and the streets are empty of traffic. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Columbus arrived in the, quote, New World 500 years ago, he wrote in his diary that the natives would make good and intelligent servants. After reading this journal entry, Michael Doris and his wife Louise Erdrich collaborated on the novel The Crown of Columbus. Now Doris has written a children's book in which he imagines the lives of two native children who were among the first to greet Columbus. Doris is a member of the Modoc tribe. He founded the Native American Studies program at Dartmouth College and has written about contemporary Native American life in his fiction and his essays. His novel, A Yellow Raft in Blue Water, is being made into a film by John Sayles. His bestseller, The Broken Cord, was about fetal alcohol syndrome, the set of problems brought on during fetal development when a pregnant woman drinks too much alcohol. Doris's adopted son had this syndrome. In 1991, as The Broken Cord was being made into a TV movie, Doris' son was killed in an accident. I spoke with Doris, and we talked first about his new children's book, Morning Girl, the story of an Indian family in 1492.
This is a part of a chapter narrated by a 10-year-old boy called Starboy, and he has been hiding out because he's mad at the world. His sister has been too nice to him. He has made a fool of himself in public, and he just doesn't know how to cope with all of this, and so he has been hiding out, ignoring the pleas of his family that he come back home and eat dinner. And this is the end of that part. When I had nothing else to think of, I simply let the air wash over me. I became the darkness. I listened to my breath as it ran in and out of my mouth like tides on the beach. I put my hands flat on the sand and felt the smoothness against my palms. I sniffed the air, got to know this great wide house, because I didn't know how long I would have to live in it. And without my ever noticing the change, I stopped being mad. I became myself. I must have slept, because I woke up and three things were different. The biting bugs had returned, the morning star had appeared in the eastern sky, and my mother had come to sit beside me. She was quiet, waiting, her body a dim shape settled so naturally into itself that until she spoke I couldn't be sure that she was not just my wish. "Tell me what you learned," she asked, her words low and like a dream. "At night," I answered in that same whispering tone. "At night, you must be your own friend." My mother took a short breath, and I knew she understood.
That's very nice, and that's something certainly children of today would find no problem relating to. Explain to us how you tried to reconstruct what it was like for the first Taino child who ran into Columbus and his fellow explorers when they landed on the islands.
Well, I didn't want it to be about that. Columbus says in his journal when he first describes the Taino that he thinks they would make good and obedient servants. And he also says that one of the first people he met was one very young girl. And so I wanted to tell a story about that girl that ended at her first sight of him, without any of the consequences, which we all understand so well, being described. I wanted it to be her story and the Taino story. So I tried to make it a kind of story that could be told through the perspective of children, which wouldn't be ethnographically incorrect, but also not pedantic. I mean, I think it has to be story first and instructional second.
This is your first children's book. Have you had trouble finding children's books with Native American characters to read to your children as they've been growing up?
I sure have, and I had trouble when I was a kid myself. So many of the books about Native Americans, I think, either portray Indians as kind of prescient. They're always having prophecy dreams of one kind or another that come true, and they're usually bad news. Or else they are kind of like earnest Boy Scouts. They are making clay pots, and they are asking questions about the origin of the universe. And they're basically not the kind of kids you would like to play with. They're much too adult-oriented and instructional kids. And so when I set out to try this, I wanted it to be first and foremost about children who parenthetically happen to be Native American and happen to live in the Bahamas in 1491 and happen to be the first ones to encounter Columbus. But that came second to character and story.
You've written about the imagery and popular culture of Indians, and you once wrote that people of proclaimed goodwill have the oddest ways of honoring American Indians. Flesh and blood Indians have been assigned the role of a popular culture metaphor. Today, their evocation connotes fuzzy images of nature, the past, plight, or summer camp. And I'll tell you, my summer camp's name was Camp Indian Head.
Hey. Whose head was that? Yes.
So does this continue on? Do you think that like popular culture is becoming any more enlightened?
I hope so. I mean, I know that, for instance, there is a class action suit on a copyright basis against the Washington Redskins that's about to come about with the idea that if you appropriate the image of another group of people and you commercialize it in a way, it absolutely obscures the reality of that group of people. It sort of sticks them at a certain point in time, and that's frustrating, and it's tacky, basically. I went to Zimbabwe this summer writing about the drought that's been going on for 7 years there and about the refugee camps of Mozambicans that are throughout the eastern part of Zimbabwe. And I come back and try and talk about that to people, and I note the same impressions of Africa with you. If you could change the name of Africa to 19th century Indians, and they would be very, very similar. I think we haven't progressed all that much.
Mm-hmm. What's the similarity that you see?
Well, they are cast in stone. They are predictable. They speak a certain way. They look a certain way. They have certain attitudes that everybody believes they know and they can recognize, when in fact, when you get there, it's a very rich and amazing place.
You are in Zimbabwe because you're on the board now of Save the Children. And, I'm wondering, as someone who's Native American, you've probably experienced what it's like when someone who's not of the culture, a white person, comes with an attitude of trying to help and isn't necessarily all that informed about what kind of help would be best.
Mm-hmm.
Were you self-conscious about being the outsider when you went to Zimbabwe to, analyze what was happening with the drought?
I was very self-conscious, and I didn't do a lot of the things that I remember people doing in communities where I had lived. For instance, I didn't go and see sick people, and I didn't go and find the obvious story of somebody who looked like they were in great distress. Rather, I listened to people who seemed very credible and never presumed to know more than an outsider knows. Basically, what I tried to do is collect testimonials from people who were there in the middle of things, and I could act as I told them, their microphone back through the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post to people of goodwill who were really, truly, genuinely interested.
What do you find offensive about the idea of writing about a very sick person or, singling out one tragedy?
Well, of course, everybody likes a story. A story makes things come to life much more than statistics do. But I know if I were sick or a member of my family were sick and an outsider who was passing through in a four-wheel drive vehicle came for 10 minutes and wanted the highlights of my distress, I would find it very offensive. It might be effective, but it doesn't make it moral.
What's the closest you came to that when you were living on a reservation and outsiders would come in?
Well, actually, one of the funny things, we used to be the beneficiary of people in Cleveland who would donate money and clothing, and this would be distributed. And one of the perks that they got for donating money and clothing is that they got to name somebody, and so we would get named.
Oh, gee.
And I must say, I once had the name Aloysius, which which I'm sure was the name of a parish that someone of very good will. And the other thing is people used to donate, I've never seen them since, undershirts with buttons on the shoulders. Whenever I think of that whole process, I think of buttons on the shoulders.
So did you grow up both liking and also both appreciating but really resenting the people from outside who were trying to help?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, when you live within the context of an overall situation, you don't analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the life that goes on. I by no means mean to disparage or discourage people who are generous. I would ask them to send both a left and a right shoe. You know, I mean, that is nice. Not one shoe doesn't do a lot of good. But I just wrote a long essay that will be in the next Mother Jones magazine about trying to explain to people in Zimbabwe the issue of how deluged we Americans are on a daily basis with good causes through the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, each one carefully packaged by a professional marketer, and each one quite worthy. And you get to the point where you think that nothing you can do can make a difference, and if you've given $10 last year and it didn't solve the problem, well, goodbye to that charity. When in fact, I think there are many things in this world that require an ongoing commitment without the expectation that it's going to succeed.
My guest is writer Michael Doris. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Doris is my guest, and he's written his first book for children, and it's called Morning Girl. Last month was the first anniversary of the death of your son, Abel, who you wrote about in your book, The Broken Cord, which is about fetal alcohol syndrome, and I suspect a lot of our listeners saw a kind of made-for-TV movie adaptation of that story. Did you have some kind of ritual for marking the anniversary of the death? Did you feel the need and the usefulness for something like that?
We planted a tree in a place that he loved, and we, with a very small group of people, talked about our complicated memories of him. And it isn't a kind of ritual that you can find in a book or anything else, but it was healing. He was a very vivid person, and I think that is why the book was written, because he demanded attention. He demanded indignation, because even with all of his exasperating qualities, of which there were many, and I don't want to gloss over those, there was within Abel a gentleness and a kindness and a patience that will instruct many of us forever. And I think it is the frustration that those qualities couldn't be available to the world in the way that they should have been that convinced Louise and me to write about our experience and encourage Abel to write the last chapter, which he did, and make a contribution by example that he couldn't make through action. And you know, I think in the final analysis, we're enormously proud of him.
You know, you use the expression complicated memories. Your complicated memories of your son. I think many people feel that to honor the dead, you should kind of forget the things they did that caused you pain and only remember the good things. And it sounds to me like what you want to do is remember your son in his full complexity and as honestly as possible.
Well, that's true. And when I did field work in Alaska about 20 years ago, I remember very well the traditional funerals of the Athabascan Dena'ina people that I lived with and whose language I learned. And the commemoration service, which generally took place a year after the death, was three parts. On the first day, you grieved very dramatically and cried and wept. The second day, you told brave stories about what the person had done, admirable things. And the third day, when everybody was really exhausted and worn out with the process, everybody told the funniest story that they ever remembered about the deceased person. And there was a relief in the laughter that came. And after that, people ate and slept. And it put a kind of closure to the experience in remembering that complexity.
What have you been able to find out about the accident that killed him?
There aren't witnesses. Since he was mentally disabled, the presumption was that it was in part his fault. I don't believe it. I devoted 2 years of my life and more to teaching Abel to cross the street. And we were so meticulous about that he would only cross after the light had been red, when it turned green. And he never made a mistake about that. He was crossing a street he had crossed 100 times from work, and I think it was not his fault. And, you know, initially there was a kind of impulse to pursue that, but finally one has to accept and go on.
So it was a hit-and-run accident?
It wasn't run. It was a hit and run and stop accident. But a person who told a different version than I have just recounted.
I see. And you've decided not to take legal action.
There's no witness. There is my knowledge and my testimony that Abel was an expert at crossing the street. But I don't think I'm going to be heard on that.
Right. You found out about your son's accident right after you landed in Los Angeles to consult for the made-for-TV movie about his life. Just one of those really horrible ironies. When something like that happens in your life, you just don't know. You're supposed to interpret that in some way? I mean, what do you do with that?
Oh, it was unbelievable because I landed and heard about this. And I wasn't able to get a plane back. He was in intensive care for several weeks, so it wasn't an immediate thing. But I wasn't able to get a plane back for hours. And so there was this thing that I had to go to in which Jimmy Smits, who played me in the movie and who is a lovely man and a wonderful actor and I think did a fine job with the film. Its goodness was in great part due to the commitment of people like him, and Ken Olin, who was the director. And so I sort of went into this meeting with the two of them, and you know, it's sort of Victor Cifuentes and Michael Stedman, and it just added a layer of surreality to the whole experience. They both were very kind and considerate and basically just kind of waited with me. And then I went back, and they have continued to be kind, and I think they made a film which I think I heard somewhere that 30 million people saw, and I hope through that experience it kind of filters into the folklore of our society that drinking during pregnancy is a risk not worth taking. That was the point of writing the book. That was the point of having it made into a film and sacrificing the amount of privacy that we sacrificed.
I want to shift the subject back again to your new children's book, Morning Girl, which, as we discussed before, is about the first Native Americans who saw Columbus when he landed. What does Columbus Day mean to you now? It's recently become a subject of great controversy.
It is, but let me transition back with you from where we are, because I don't think they're unrelated, what we've just been talking about with this book, because one of the things that a writer can do is imagine. And in that I've had children who were deprived of their fullness by fetal alcohol syndrome, in effect, when I set out to write children characters and to write in their voice, I wanted to have fully invested kids. And I'm sure that my own children were in my mind as to who they might have been, could have been, and should have been. And so I have a special affection for Starboy and Morning Girl. And I don't really want to confuse them with Columbus. This is their story. And the thing about the coincidence of Columbus bumping into these people just at the time that these two kids were about to reach maturity is that they didn't have the chance to do it. They were, through no desire of Columbus's, I don't think, victims of European diseases and didn't survive, the Taino people, for more than a generation or so, except those who were brought back as slaves by Columbus in subsequent voyages. They deserve a voice that is not mixed with the fact that they were the first, they were the welcome wagon. I know it sounds kind of strange to say that when the book is published around the time of the quincentennial, but I think maybe especially because the book is published around the time of the quincentennial. I go into bookstores, children's bookstores now, and there are shelves full of I Was a Cabin Boy with Christopher Columbus and the voyages of 1492 and the heroics of Columbus and all of this kind of stuff. And I think, where are the Taino in all of this? Where are these people who for at least 2,000 years had a complex, civilized, and fulfilling life for themselves? And I think one of the greatest injustices is that they vanish in fiction even as they vanished in fact. And I hope that people who read this will remember them, even though I'm sure I made a million mistakes, and it's all made up. And it's totally presumptuous on the part of some 20th century mixed-blood person to try and imagine what life might have been like in that community, except that I did imagine they had a sense of humor, and I did imagine that they were complicated, and I did imagine that they had imaginative lives. And you don't find enough Native American characters with those qualities.
Well, Michael Doris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Doris's new children's book, set in 1492, is called Morning Girl. It's published by Hyperion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The ACLU recently released its list of the Arts Censors of the Year. Coming up, we'll talk with the director of the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project about her selections of the Censors of the Year. And critic Maureen Corrigan, who is a lapsed Catholic, reviews Catholic Girls, a collection of essays by women writers who grew up Catholic, from Mary Gordon to Audre Lorde. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. By a tally of 74-25, the Senate has voted to override President Bush's veto of a bill to re-regulate cable television, paving the way for what may be the first override of a Bush veto. The measure now goes on to the House, where a vote is expected later on tonight. The vote in the Senate was 74-25, well above the two-thirds needed, and came despite a White House lobbying campaign. The cable TV bill would require the FCC to set rates for basic cable service in communities where cable companies operate as monopolies. It also is designed to increase competition. In Angola, the government has tightened security around its capital after the main opposition party threatened to renew civil war. Eight generals from the National Front for the Total Independence of Angola stormed out of a meeting with officials in charge of this week's elections. The generals demanded the election be canceled, and they pulled their troops from the country's recently united armed forces. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Luanda.
Angola's national armed forces were split tonight when former generals of the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola announced they were pulling their men out to protest the results of last week's democratic elections. General Arlindo Benben Pena, the nephew of UNITA leader Jonas Savimbi, demanded the election process be reviewed or canceled. He warned the National Election Council not to publish results of last week's elections. Pena threatened to take up arms against the government if his demands were not met. Angola's ruling party appeared headed for victory in last week's elections, which most foreign observers saw as free and fair. But UNITA claims widespread election fraud. UNITA fought a 16-year civil war against Angola's former Soviet-backed government, which ended in a ceasefire agreement last year and led to last week's elections. I am Suni Khalid in Luanda, Angola.
President Bush appeared today at a campaign rally in Delaware where he spoke in favor of his own record on children's issues and slammed Bill Clinton's. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president took credit for passing a comprehensive child care program, one of his earliest initiatives and one of the few that has won approval from Congress. He also took credit for proposing last week a new child support policy that would crack down on fathers who don't pay child support. He pointed to an increase in Head Start funding by 127% during his administration. Bill Clinton, the president claimed, presided over a state where the death rate for children got worse during the 1980s, while it improved nationwide. And President Bush pointed out that the child welfare system in Arkansas was so bad, children's advocates sued the governor. 4 months ago, that suit was settled. The Clinton campaign shot back with the facts, attacking the president's record and defending the governor's. They used another study to show that Arkansas's child death rate was less than a fourth of what the president claimed. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
This is NPR News. In Bosnia, five UN planes carried food and medical supplies to Sarajevo today after flights resumed over the weekend. Aid flights had been grounded for 1 month after one plane was shot down by a ground-to-air missile. Power is off to about 80% of the capital, and UN peacekeepers hoping to restore it have been fired upon by snipers. Local government officials say that new attacks by Serbian factions are apparently an effort to divide the city. One UN official says that children will start dying of starvation within 1 month unless there is a huge increase in the amount of food sent in. In New York City, the stock market rebounded today after falling more than 100 points this morning and ended 21.5 points lower for the day. NPR's John Edstey reports.
It was a wild morning in the stock market, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling 105 points in what some traders were calling a selling frenzy. During the sell-off, the market reached its lowest point of the year. Analysts attributed the drop to investor concern over the weakness of the U.S. economy and disappointment that despite negative reports on the economy last week, the Federal Reserve has not yet responded with another interest rate cut. Those concerns had led to a sharp 54-point drop on Friday, and traders came in this morning concerned that the trend would continue. For a time it did, but by late morning the market was already regaining lost ground as bargain hunters moved in. And by closing time, the Dow was down just 21.5 points. I'm John Idstein in Washington.
At least three people are missing after an explosion hit a power plant in Marin, Indiana. This morning, after fire broke out, some people had to be rescued by helicopters from on top of the burning building. An official said the blaze occurred after an explosion at the 8-year-old coal-fired plant. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The ACLU recently announced its selection of the Arts Censors of the Year. A list of private individuals and public officials, the ACLU says, have shown exceptional disregard for the First Amendment and artistic expression. The list includes Anna Melda Radice, acting chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. She was chosen for agreeing to veto grants for sexually explicit art. Reverend Donald Wildman is cited for a lifetime of disservice to the values of the Bill of Rights in his pursuit of one goal, the restructuring of American law to reflect his own moral code. We called Marjorie Hines, the director of the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project, which made the selections. I asked her if there is a theme that unites the individuals chosen as Arts Censors of the Year.
Well, the main theme that emerges is regardless of what their particular political ideology is, and some of them are quote-unquote feminists like Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, and some of them are religious right fundamentalists like Donald Wildman, but what unites them all is an intolerance for the viewpoints of others and a desire to impose their particular ideology, be it religious or political or both, on society, on everybody else, by suppressing, silencing, and punishing creative expression that they disagree with.
Let's look at some of the recipients of your Art Censors of the Year awards. And you've divided this into two categories, government art censors and private art censors.
Right.
Why don't we start with government art censors? And you have the Duval County, Florida Public School District on your list. What happened there?
Well, there are a lot of public school districts around the country that have, either because they have on their own boards people who want to impose a particular ideological agenda or because they are responding to pressures from groups of parents, small groups of parents. But all of them, the Duval County, Florida Public School District, their name has come up repeatedly. And they have removed more than 60 books over the last couple of years from the school library, including many, many classics, J.D. Salinger, William Faulkner, and this year they removed Snow White, the fairy tale, because somebody objected to its violence. The problem of purging books from school libraries in response to ideological pressure groups is a very serious one.
The Omaha City Councilman Steve Exon makes your list.
Well, Steve Exon decided to go on a crusade against rap music and joined up with a group in Omaha called Omaha for Decency, and they organized a sting operation. They sent teenagers into music stores, and a number of them were able to purchase, or so they alleged, the latest Two Live Crew recording. And then Exxon prevailed upon the prosecutor in Omaha to prosecute these record store owners under the state harmful to minors laws for the crime of selling music.
And you have a problem with prosecuting record store owners for selling records?
It's really prosecuting musicians and music store owners for crime, for the crime of obscenity or disseminating material harmful to minors, is really a very new development in the United States. And it's very troubling because all art forms by their nature are ambiguous. And it's very hard to argue that there should be anything criminal about art. And music is especially so. You've got sound, you've got rhythm, and you've got lyrics. And to try to separate out lyrics from the rest of a musical production and then criminally prosecute musicians or music stores is alarming.
Well, this kind of ties in with a couple of people who made your list of the private art censors of the year, Oliver North and Jack Thompson, who led a campaign against Ice-T's song Cop Killer. Now, this is the same Oliver North of the Iran-Contra affair.
It is, and he now has created a private organization for himself, which I gather is promoting what he views as correct, politically correct patriotic values. And one of his issues now is the dangers, so-called dangers of words and music. And he was really a leader in the crusade to suppress this song, Cop Killer, which is an example of a whole genre of rap music, which is highly politicized, highly radical, and highly critical of the powers that be, and in particular the police and their behavior in minority communities. And so it's very dangerous when you see whether government or private individuals flexing their muscles in a way that silences and suppresses a point of view that needs to be heard.
Okay, so Oliver North, you say, was leading this campaign against Ice-T's record Cop Killer. Who is Jack Thompson?
Thompson is a lawyer in Florida who originally achieved notoriety by becoming very actively involved in the prosecutions a couple of years ago of Two Live Crew for obscenity. And ultimately, all of those prosecutions were unsuccessful, although in one case it took 2 years to get a lower court decision reversed. When it came to Cop Killer and this category of rap called gangster rap, obscenity prosecutions are really not a viable option because, for the most part, the music is not about sex. It's about politics and racism. And so North and Thompson got the idea that they would try to get prosecutions of this singer and Time Warner, his producer, under sedition laws or anarchy laws because they thought that this music was politically radical and revolutionary and therefore should be suppressed. And that's what they were advocating. They haven't yet gotten any state or local prosecutor to bring such a prosecution, probably because it would be clearly unconstitutional, but that is what they have attempted.
You're saying that these rap records are about politics and racism, and that's why people object to it, but isn't it really because people interpret the records as advocating violence and, in this instance, advocating killing police?
Again, you know, a piece of music, a piece of poetry, a piece of art, it's very hard to narrow it down or reduce something that is a work of the imagination or fantasy and is complicated to a simple message. And you could take innumerable examples from the visual arts, film, novels. A lot of our art describes crime, so that I wouldn't necessarily agree that the song advocates violence against police officers. But even if it did, the law is pretty clear that the First Amendment protects even incendiary speech, even advocacy of violence, unless it rises to the level of actual incitement. It's pretty clear that you can't sue an artist or a record company for producing a work that documents, describes, arguably even advocates. If you had such a crime, if you had such a rule of law, number one, you would be letting the criminal off the hook. And in this country, under our legal system, we give people responsibility for their actions. There's a clear differentiation between words, thoughts, emotions, and fantasies on the one hand and antisocial acts on the other. And we don't let criminals off the hook because they heard a record or read a book. If we did, incidentally, the Bible would have to be the first work of art to be banned because there's probably more documentation of psychopathic criminals claiming inspiration from the Bible, whether for murders, for child abuse, for wife beating. So we don't allow people to escape criminal responsibility.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marjorie Hines, and she's the project director of the ACLU Arts Censorship Project. They recently released their list of the Art Censors of the Year. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Marjorie Hines is my guest. She directs the ACLU Arts Censorship Project. You know, in large part because of the Parents Music Resource Center, the group that was co-founded by Tip Gore, the record industry has instituted a voluntary labeling system. I wonder what you think of that, if you think of that as self-censorship.
Well, it's certainly self-censorship. It's not a First Amendment matter, technically, because the record industry is not the government, and the First Amendment only prevents the government from engaging in censorship. It was clearly a response to pressures, to political pressures that were brought to bear on the industry. The industry was hoping that, I suppose, that as a result of voluntary self-censorship, it would not have to face legislation, mandatory labeling, or other kinds of government-imposed censorship. I think they were mistaken, because what we've seen in the years since the parental advisory label came into effect is a couple of very dangerous things. One is proposed legislation in a number of states, and it hasn't been passed anywhere yet, but in Louisiana last year, it was saved from passage only by a governor's veto. Legislation which relies on the parental advisory warning to trigger criminal penalties for sales to minors. And those laws would be unconstitutional, but they can do a lot of harm before they're struck down in the courts. Number two, even without laws that rely on the label, we're seeing a lot of music stores, especially the bigger chains that have leases and malls, simply saying, we will not carry labeled music. And undoubtedly, the impact of this is discriminatory against rap and rock music. You don't see country music getting labeled. You don't see opera getting labeled, even though the lyrics may be just as steamy and suggestive.
Going down the list of private art censors, you have Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, who you cite for drafting and advocating legislation that would allow lawsuits to ban sexually oriented entertainment and to allow victims of sexual crimes to collect damages from the producers and distributors of such entertainment.
Dworkin and McKinnon are very important to recognize as censors. I should say that, like the other private individuals we've named, they obviously have First Amendment rights to advocate what they advocate, and we would defend their right to do so. But we also think it's important to point out that what they are advocating is censorship, and if they are successful, we will have a suppression of art that may be valuable and that people certainly have a right to choose and make decisions about for themselves.
What McKinnon and Dworkin are advocating is if a woman is a victim of a sex crime, that what? Who should she be able to sue?
Two things. The original ordinance that they drafted and that was enacted in Indianapolis and then struck down by the courts would have allowed anybody, essentially, who was offended by a work of what they defined as pornography, and they have their own particular definition of pornography, which is quite different from any court definition we've seen of obscenity. But anything that met that definition, anybody essentially could sue to stop it. And a very straightforward kind of censorship. And what they were trying to get at was material that they felt was degrading to women or insulting to women. That law was properly struck down by the courts because, first of all, it's incredibly subjective. Second of all, government is not permitted to suppress any type of speech based on the viewpoint that's expressed, even if it's a viewpoint we don't like.
One last question for you. You're a First Amendment lawyer who is now focusing on the arts and civil liberties. Has it given you
any new insights into First Amendment law or into American culture, you know, to be focusing on the arts as you have been?
It has made me, I think, more of a principled First Amendment believer. We all, but many, many Americans, probably the majority, believe in free speech in the abstract. But for almost all of us, there is something that pushes our envelope, and we begin to waver in our principles, and we think, oh, well, that is so awful. Surely the government should be allowed to suppress or punish it. Working in this area, sometimes with songs or images or performers whose work is very disturbing or shocking to some people, has given me a better understanding of the importance of allowing that creativity to be expressed. Ultimately, that helps. Does freedom of expression not cause actual crimes or other harms to society, but it really helps. It's a safety valve to allow that expression, for example, the expressions of rage that we hear in rap music. That's a form of safety valve. And it gets the information out there so that society can respond, hopefully, with positive changes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for your interest. A lot.
Marjorie Hines directs the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Nina Totenberg reviews the Supreme Court term opening today and the effect the election could have on the court, plus checking into some of the cases. We'll have more on the El Al cargo plane crash in Amsterdam, a death toll in the hundreds there. Our colleague Linda Wertheimer reports from California, from Orange County, in fact, checking in to the present state of mind of Perot's supporters. Some are saying they feel like jilted lovers. Also, Lynn Neary has the story of John Murphy, a former slave who founded the Afro-American newspaper in Baltimore. It's now 100 years old.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the weekend on Saturday Night Live, Sinead O'Connor stunned viewers by ripping up a picture of the Pope. NBC immediately received 500 outraged phone calls. Critic Maureen Corrigan says Sinead may have vented her anger more constructively by contributing to a new book titled Catholic Girls. It's filled with essays, short stories, and poems by women who were raised Catholic.
The day it first occurred to me that maybe other people found Catholics a little peculiar was the day that Pope John XXIII came to New York to address the UN. I think I was in the third grade, and I was lined up with my classmates from St. Raphael's Parochial School along Queens Boulevard. We were all waiting to catch a glimpse of the Pope when he rode from Kennedy Airport to the UN in Manhattan. I remember it was a raw, cloudy day, and my teeth were chattering because the nuns had insisted we all leave our coats back at school. It was very important, they told us, that the Pope see our green plaid uniforms. Hours went by, and no pontiff. But at some point during that chilly vigil, the man who owned the neighborhood Jewish deli came out and cornered the nuns. I couldn't hear what he was saying. I just saw his hands moving up and down and all around like he was really angry. He disappeared back into the store, but he came out again soon, and he was carrying containers of hot chocolate. We all got some, even the nuns. I did finally see a white papal blur whiz by that day, but my most vivid memory is the righteous outrage of that Jewish deli man seeing all us kids out there shivering in our uniforms. Years later, I realized that his agitated hand gestures translated into one word, Mashugana. Some of us are still a little crazy after all these years, and the pieces in Catholic Girls tell why. Writers like Audre Lorde and Sharon Myers angrily remember how their own young voices were silenced in deference to the church's version of truth. Others, like Mary Gordon, feel more positive about their Catholic girlhoods. But taken together, these pieces tell what it was like for generations of women to grow up in an intense, polarized world of good and evil, guilt and absolution. Some highlights from the collection include a funny memoir by Melissa Anderson Lowry about her older sister deciding to enter the convent over her parents' objections. Lowry recalls that the local parish nuns smelled victory and began circling the house like seagulls over a plate of French fries. Carolyn Banks writes about the night the Virgin Mary appeared in her neighborhood, but only to Polish Catholics. Other stories focus on less lighthearted Catholic girls, ones who desperately prayed to God to stop a parent's drinking or protect them from sexual abuse. I suppose for non-Catholics, reading this collection will be like going on an exotic anthropological excursion. But for me, it's like being in a room filled with women who only have to say one word to each other, a word like scapular or lepers or Saint Bernadette, and we all immediately recognize each other as soulmates. One final note, Catholic Girls is already in the bookstores. But it would have been more appropriate if the publishers had stuck to their original publication date of October 29th. That's right before the Feast of All Souls and the Feast of All Saints. See? Even an old, fallen-away Catholic girl never forgets.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed the anthology Catholic Girls. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Orjiva Blaitis. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with law professor Derek Bell. Bell was the first African-American professor to receive tenure at Harvard Law School. He took a leave of absence to protest the lack of a tenured African-American woman, who later resigned. Bell has a new book about the permanence of racism in America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.